The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. That website address again is gsuggsinsurance.com. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated July 5/August 1, 2022. It is, as usual, bordered in red with a narrow inner border of white. Time, in large capital block letters, appear in gray, superimposed upon lighter gray, degraded to white or upgraded to white on the cover. There's a black and white photograph of a woman looking somber, looking into the lens of the camera. Her hair, which is medium dark, this is black and white, so I'm not sure what the color spectrum would indicate, is fairly long. It's at least shoulder length, brushed behind her neck and shoulders, parted in the center. Again, her eyes are reflecting light, but I'm unable to tell you the color. It looks like she has some kind of lip coloring on. We see only the neck line of her outfit, of her clothing. It appears to be pale gray or perhaps off-white. The collar is a stand-up collar going to a V-neck. This is First Lady Olena Zelenska. And the heading on the cover page, or on the, yeah, the cover page says, Her Private War. Beginning with short pieces from For the Record. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 0.9998 dollars, equaling the value of €1, July 13, bringing the euro to parity with the U.S. dollar for the first time in 20 years. They said I couldn't buy Twitter. Then they would not disclose bot info. Now they want to force me to buy Twitter in court. Now they have to disclose bot info in court. By Elon Musk, Tesla co-founder, in a meme he posted to Twitter after saying he's breaking off a $44 billion deal to buy the platform, Twitter sued Musk July 12. He had so many dreams, spoken by Maria Tutul, speaking to CNN on Espanol about her cousin, Juan Wilmer Tulul Tepaz, 14, one of 53 people who died after being trapped in a truck carrying migrants, found June 27 in San Antonio. Here's 8 trillion. It's in bold capital lettering. Let me see if I've got that right. 8,000,000,000,000. Population of the world by November, according to a UN projection released July 11. I can't rest as her humanity is being stripped from her. This is by Sherelle Greiner, wife of Brittany Greiner, July 6. The WNBA star faces 10 years in a Russian prison after pleading guilty to carrying hash oil into the country. 19 feet, the height of the Georgia Guidestones Monument, before it was bombed July 6th and demolished, the structure, unveiled in 1980, had become the target of right-wing conspiracy theories. The last few months have shown one thing. Putin knows no taboos. Spoken by Tim Kaler, managing director of the German gas industry association Zukunft Gas, on fears Russia could extend a scheduled maintenance shutdown of the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, which began July 11, to punish Europe. "You have to do more," stated Manuel Oliver, whose son Joaquin was killed in the 2018 shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, interrupting President Joe Biden's July 11 Rose Garden speech, celebrating the passage of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which introduces new gun safety measures. And that was for the record. Now to the brief. This shows a photo on the title page. Well, two photos. No, it's one photo superimposed on another. It says, "The Case Against Trump," by Eric Cortalesa. "New evidence from the January 6 hearings increases the chance the former president will face prosecution." Okay, the upper photograph that is apparently something being shown on a large screen in a room, which is also probably large, but it shows a former President Donald Trump at his desk with his phone to his left ear. Behind him, it's a rather murky, jammed-up looking photograph, but apparently there's a flag in the background. It looks like blue skies. Perhaps he's seated with his back to a window. He's dressed in dark blue with a white shirt and a bright red tie. Then below that is almost like a separate panel, but I really think this video screen photo is above what I'm describing as the lower panel photo, because we see there Chairman Thompson of the January 6th Conspiracy Committee, seated next to Congresswoman Cheney, and they are seated at a large brown wooden dais behind which are flags. Three United States of America flags, the stars and stripes, and then interspersed there are two, which is apparently the presidential seal. It's hard to see because the two people are seated in front of them. The brief opener, again, this is by Eric Cortalesa. "Not long ago, few in Washington thought Donald Trump would face prosecution for the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol January 6, 2021. Trump did not directly participate in the riot, unlike nearly all of the more than 800 people the Justice Department has charged as part of its wide-ranging investigation. The former president's allies have claimed the violence that day came as a surprise to them and to Trump, and some of his defenders suggested that even if he could be linked to specific crimes, he lacked the criminal intent legally required for conviction because he really believed the 2020 election had been stolen. Now, after seven hearings by the House committee investigating the January 6 attack, the picture has changed. In widely watched testimony, former Trump aides have said under oath the former president was repeatedly told his claims of significant voter fraud were baseless. The committee has also produced evidence Trump urged his supporters to march to the Capitol, even after the Secret Service told him many in the crowd were heavily armed. And he tried to recruit the Republican National Committee to help submit fraudulent electors to the Electoral College. Trump dismissed the committee's work, calling it a hoax run by political hacks and thugs, but the sworn testimony of eyewitnesses carries weight under the law. Multiple former prosecutors from both political parties say Trump may now be vulnerable to at least 5 federal charges. Conspiracy to defraud the U.S., attempt to obstruct an official act of Congress, inciting an insurrection, attempt to intimidate a U.S. government official, and most seriously, seditious conspiracy. He has gone into a whole different category of potential criminal liability, says Harry Littman, former U.S. attorney for Western Pennsylvania. The Justice Department has never indicted a former president, much less one who may run against the sitting commander-in-chief. It is a nightmare scenario for those who seek to shield federal law enforcement from accusations of political bias. That is one reason prosecutors would have to be sure they could make a case against Trump's stick before bringing an indictment. Despite the committee's work, it is still far from clear they have the goods. Any lawyer telling you that this would be any easy case, says Renato Mariotti, a former federal prosecutor for the Northern District of Illinois, or no problem at all the evidence is right there, is misleading. On some potential charges, the Justice Department would face a high burden of proof. On anything involving fraud, intent is a key factor. Trump's main legal defense, in other words, could be a version of the George Costanza line, "It's not a lie if you believe it." That may be why some of the earliest evidence the committee presented detailed all the times Trump was told he had lost the election, and that his schemes to nullify Joe Biden's victory did not pass legal muster. Greg Jacob, top legal counsel to former Vice President Mike Pence, testified, "Even John Eastman, a right-wing lawyer who was the most active proponent of blocking the January 6, 2021 certification of the Electoral College, acknowledged in a meeting with Trump 2 days earlier the plan was legally unsound." That fact and other evidence presented by the committee would incriminate Trump, even if he really believed the election was stolen from him. Trying to stop congressional certification of the Electoral College, especially by force, is a crime, and Trump would be hard-pressed to claim he did not intend to do that, says Barbara McQuaid, a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. The same goes for trying to submit fraudulent electors for certification. No matter what he may believe about whether he won or lost the election, he is not allowed to be part of submitting a forged electoral slate, says Norm Eisen, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution who served as counsel to the House during its first impeachment of Trump. For all that, Attorney General Merrick Garland will have to weigh other factors before giving the green light for a case against Trump. Millions of Trump supporters might view the move as politically motivated, eroding the public's faith that the feds use their massive powers to uphold the law, not to advance the interests of politicians. Bringing America's first case against a former president, even if it were a lock, could also lower the bar for less principled future prosecutions. But as the evidence against Trump mounts, choosing not to indict is not cost-free either, as it could undermine the democratic principle that the law applies equally to everyone. If you let him get away with it, does it suggest that if you're a former president, you are above the law? McQuaid says, only a few people know whether Trump is even under formal investigation, but more lawmakers are calling for the committee to make a criminal referral to the Justice Department. I think he should be held accountable, says Representative Elaine Luria, a Virginia Democrat on the January 6 panel. For now, the committee remains focused on setting down for history the most thorough account of the January 6 attack and the events leading to it. What justice makes of the, that's justice with a capital J, makes of the evidence produced in the process is ultimately up to Garland. From the news ticker, three short items. Biden trip seeks to affirm Mideast ties. President Biden arrived in the Middle East July 13 with the goals of strengthening relationships between Israel and Saudi Arabia, slowing Iran's nuclear program, and increasing oil flow to the West. The trip has been criticized for the planned meeting with Saudi Crown Prince, who's been implicated in Jamal Khashoggi's murder. Russia buying Iranian UAVs, U.S. says. Iran's preparing to send Russia armed drones for use in the Ukraine war as part of a secret deal to aid the Kremlin, the White House said July 11. Tehran plans to ship as many as several hundred drones on an expedited timeline and train Russian troops to use them, officials said. Pulse oximeters less accurate for patients of color. Inaccurate pulsometer readings led healthcare providers to give less oxygen to Black, Hispanic, and Asian ICU patients, according to a July 11 study in JAMA, Internal Medicine. The finger clip medical devices became ubiquitous during the COVID-19 pandemic, but have been found to overestimate the blood oxygen of patients with darker skin. Here's a photo with a caption. It is a stately-looking room, white, with Corinthian pillars and other columns squared off, and a huge chandelier further down the hallway through at least six archways. It is a packed house. I do not know if people are seated or standing. Some are wearing masks, some are not. Some are wearing baseball caps, others are not. There are men and women and some children in the crowd in fairly colorful shirts or blouses, which is all that I can see in the photo besides the faces. Lots of blues and reds and purples and pinks, and the caption reads, "The People's Palace." Angry protesters camp out in the Sri Lankan presidential palace in Colombo, July 11, following months of demonstrations over the country's economic meltdown amid soaring food and fuel prices. Sri Lankans stormed the residence to force President Gotabaya Rajapaksa and the country's prime minister, whom they blame for the crisis, to leave office. After hiding out from protesters, Rajapaksa, the president, fled the country July 13 on a military plane. The bulletin, Akron police shooting sparks calls for DOJ investigation. This is by Sonia Mansour. The police killing of Jayland Walker, a 25-year-old Black man who had more than 60 gunshot wounds, June 27, in Akron, Ohio, led to large-scale protests in the city and in Washington, D.C. Body cam video from some of the officers who were on the scene when Walker was killed has raised more questions than answers for many. Activists say pledges by city and state officials to investigate the shooting are not enough. The events that led to Walker's killing began when an officer tried to pull him over for a traffic violation, and he fled. The situation escalated after the officer reported a shot was fired from Walker's car. Walker then got out and ran. Eight officers began shooting, firing more than 90 times, according to his family's attorney. Officers handcuffed Walker, who was unarmed, even after shooting him. Police said they later found a handgun on the front seat of Walker's car. The police union has said it believes that use of force was justified. The Reverend Ray Green, Jr., executive director of the Freedom Block in Akron, says Walker's death sparked such a response in part because of Akron police's repeated targeting of the black community. Why are we training officers to eliminate the threat of a citizen of the city that they live in? This isn't a war. You do not eliminate the threat, Green says. While there have been some reforms over the past two decades, to Green, they represent incremental ways to keep people satisfied, keep people shut up. Local activists and Walker's family are calling for a federal investigation into Walker's death. President Joe Biden said July 6 the Justice Department is closely monitoring the case. Green, for his part, urges Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, which would provide greater accountability and tracking of police shootings and use of force. We do not want incremental change, he says. We need revolutionary change today. Two more items from News Ticker. Olympic hero says he was trafficked. Mo Farah, a four-time Olympic gold medalist, told the BBC July 11 he was trafficked to the UK at age 9 under a false name by a woman who forced him to work in her home as a domestic servant. Thousands of Uber files leaked, documents from 2013 to 2017, detailing how ride-hailing firm Uber, U-B-E-R, lobbied politicians and evaded local authorities as part of its global expansion, were leaked by a former lobbyist July 10. Uber acknowledged past wrongdoing and said it had since changed its ways. A small insert here featuring two photos and a caption, Space Peering into the Past. NASA released the first full-color images taken by the new $10 billion James Webb Space Telescope, July 11 and July 12. At left is a galaxy cluster, apparently named SMACS Space 0723, the light from which traveled for 13.1 billion years, offering one of the deepest looks into space humans have ever had. At right, the Southern Ring Nebula, one of the brightest nebulae in the night sky. Now, the furthest left photo is black in the background, very, very black, according to this photo, which has apparently been downloaded from this $10 billion James Webb Space Telescope. And the stars are startling in their brilliance. They are absolutely like white 4th of July sparklers. And then in the background, what looks like it might just be floating debris or rubble or something like that, it looks like it's floating in this density of darkness in varying colors and shades of white, yellow, off-white, gold, orange. Some appear to be circular, as if we're looking at the sun or our Earth or other planets with which Earthlings are more familiar, and others look like little chips, like little chips from broken pottery or glass. And then the other photo on the right, that is the Southern Ring Nebula, looks like a giant blobby opal. It has that bluish iridescent quality with a star in the center, and then around it are kind of like golden ripples coming off of it. I don't know if they're gaseous matter or just golden ripples falling from this huge star blue, star opal looking thing, and again, against a very densely dark background of space with a few little bright stars around the edges. Well, here on the next page, it's called Milestones. We see the back of a human. Again, this looks like dark space. It's apparently a dark black doorway. There's a number 10 posted on it. And we see the back of a blonde-haired man wearing a dark blue suit. And the caption reads, Johnson at Downing Street after making his resignation statement July 7. Resigned. Boris Johnson, the party goes on without him. By Billy Perigo. After months of escalating scandals, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson said July 7 he would step down as leader of his ruling Conservative Party and ultimately the country. It was not the political end Johnson had imagined. In December 2019, he delivered his party its most significant electoral majority in a generation with a mandate to get Brexit done and level up poorer regions. He had a reputation for shrugging off criticism and recently said he wanted to remain in power till the 2030s. But mismanagement of the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, and most of all, a series of lurid ethics scandals caught up with him. His hand was forced when more than 50 government officials resigned in a 48-hour period, leaving him unable to govern. In the last few days, I have tried to persuade my colleagues that it would be eccentric to change governments when we are delivering so much, Johnson said, while announcing his resignation on the steps of 10 Downing Street. I regret not to have been successful in those arguments. The last straw was a sexual abuse scandal. Chris Pincher, a senior member of Johnson's government, resigned July 1 after allegations he recently groped two men at a private members' club. It emerged Johnson had been briefed on a previous allegation against Pincher, but had promoted him anyway. Johnson did not deny claims. He had referred to the lawmaker as Pincher by name, Pincher by nature. That was only the latest in a series of scandals for Johnson. In late 2021 and early 2022, newspapers reported dozens of illegal parties had been held at Downing Street during strict COVID-19 lockdowns. Police investigated and found Johnson had broken the law by attending, a first for a sitting prime minister. Even though he resigned as party leader, Johnson will remain prime minister till the contest to replace him is completed September 5. That contest has already begun, with several candidates in the running, including former finance minister Rishi Sunak and foreign secretary Liz Truss. Almost all of them sit to the right of Johnson on the political spectrum. Already, some have pledged to lower taxes, slash government departments, cut public spending. Several have criticized woke cultural attitudes. The contenders will be whittled down by conservative lawmakers in the coming weeks before the remaining two are voted on by card-carrying party members who skew older, whiter, and wealthier than the general public. The earliest opportunity for most Brits to have a say on their new prime minister will be at the next general election, not until late 2024 or early 2025. Also on the milestones page, six more items. Died actor James Caan, C-A-A-N, best known for his role in The Godfather at 82, July 6. Nominated HBO's Succession for 25 Emmy Awards July 12, including a record 14 for acting. Killed Maher al-Ajjal, a leader of the Islamic State group in Syria, in a drone strike announced by the U.S. military July 12. Threatened some 500 mature sequoia trees in Yosemite National Park by a wildfire that had burned 3.7 square miles as of July 11. Dropped Columbia University from the U.S. News and World Report Best Colleges list July 7 following questions about the school's data. Capped, the daily numbers of passengers departing London's Heathrow Airport at 100,000 due to capacity constraints, July 12. The D.C. brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. About 30 miles west of Grand Junction, Colorado, aspiring paleontologists can sidle up next to working professionals and guides from the museums of Western Colorado. There they offer half-day, full-day, and multi-day visits to the Maigat Moore Quarry, which has been pulling up dinosaur bones with regularity since the early 1980s. The visits are not cheap, can be hellishly hot and dusty, and guests cannot keep what they find. This is protected land. But it is a great way to get up close to an extinct species like the Allosaurus. For those looking to save a few bucks but see a similarly past its heyday species, one could also dust off what remains of the Colorado Republican Party. Once mighty, it has atrophied in recent years. Although not yet extinct, no one would accuse it of being a real force. In fact, in the June 28 primaries, not a single incumbent was seeking renomination to statewide office, and most of the races featured at least one supporter of former President Donald Trump's big lie. The results were mixed, with some mainstream candidates fending off the conspiracy caucus, but just barely. From the outside, Colorado parties condition as a cautionary tale about what happens when the establishment abdicates its protective role. Trumpism cost five-term Representative Scott Tipton renomination in the 2020 Republican primary against a MAGA celebrity. As Colorado tends bluer, the red-hatted Republicans now in charge may soon find themselves equally as buried as those dinosaur digs, relics of another era, in a key state. The coronavirus brief by Jeffrey Kluger, editor at large. Since COVID-19 began spreading in the U.S., Americans have disagreed about the pandemic response, arguing over everything from vaccines to masks to homeschooling and more. Now a new survey by the Pew Research Center suggests that little has changed. For starters, health authorities, including those from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, are feeling the love from some groups but not from others. About 72% of Democrats say public health officials have done a good or excellent job of responding to the pandemic, compared with just 29% of Republicans. People also hold different views on vaccines, which continue to divide us. Only 55% of Americans say vaccination has been extremely or very effective at limiting the spread of the disease. The rest are evenly divided between saying it's been somewhat effective and that it has had little or no effect. If you look at the science, there is little debate on this point. A study published in June 2022 estimated COVID vaccines saved an estimated 20 million lives globally in the first year they were available. As to the near radioactive debate over masking, the nation is split down the middle, with 48% saying masks and social distancing have been extremely or very effective at limiting the spread of the disease, and a near equal amount saying they've had little or no effect. Again, research has found in favor of these practices, including a 2021 Nature Communications study finding people who reliably wore masks were 62% less likely to contract COVID-19 than those who did not. Finally, for the person who inevitably takes the most heat or praise in any national emergency like a pandemic, the president, the numbers offer no joy. At the beginning of President Joe Biden's term, 65% of Americans said they were confident in his ability to deal with the outbreak. Now, not so much. Only 43% say he's doing a good or excellent job at handling the pandemic, compared with 56% who say his performance has been only fair or poor. Unlike former President Donald Trump, Biden might have avoided contracting the disease so far, but as the survey shows, he is decidedly feeling its pain. The View Nation heads this article, "What a Four-Year-Old Saw at a Mass Shooting," by Julia Fine. Okay, here's a picture. The caption says, "Leora, at the 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, where people to her immediate right were killed." It's a little girl in a dress, white, with bright blue stars all over it. She's wearing kids. I guess they're kids. And she's got a red wagon with some stuff in it beside her. She's watching a band marching down an avenue. The band looks like maybe high schoolers or even college students. Big white tubas. All the folks are in the band are dressed in blue and khaki. And opposite where Leora is standing are trees and shops with red and white awnings, and flags are flying and so forth and so on. And at least a dozen people are seated in front of Leora, and a few off to her right by a fire plug. At school, Friday, July 1, 4.5-year-old Leora drew 4 white crayon figures on black paper, smiling beneath a neon firework display. This was a picture of her family at the Highland Park 4th of July celebration. The event would be canceled, the community shaken, after a mass shooting at the morning parade left 7 dead and dozens injured. In its place, a manhunt would spread terror throughout the Chicago suburb as residents sheltered in place. When evening fell, Leora would be huddled in her parents' room asking about the bad man that wants to shoot us, while her little brother kept repeating, "Scary part, run." But Friday, she and her family knew none of this. They, like so many of us, went into the long weekend excited for some pandemic-safe holiday fun. I first met Leora when she was our 6-month-old neighbor, around the same age as my son. They crawled together at the playground, swam in baby pools, made messes of sensory bins. July 4, this sweet, rosy-cheeked child saw people at a family parade gunned down in front of her. Leora was standing out ahead of us, waving at the people in the parade. 3 people who were sitting in chairs right in front of her Monday are now confirmed dead, says my friend Melissa, her mother. "Those people in those chairs took bullets for our children, who were ducking for cover right next to them. I thought my son was going to die in my arms. I thought I was going to watch my daughter die on the ground." I asked Melissa how she knew right away that the sound was a gun rather than fireworks. "There have already been over 300 mass shootings this year," she says. "I've been thinking for a long time it's just a matter of time before one of us is in one. When I heard those shots, I knew this is it, this is our time." Melissa and I planned this conversation around our kids' schedules. Routine provides stability when children are processing trauma. But as their parents, we no longer have the luxury of diving back into our own routines. What happened in Highland Park is happening too often to too many Americans. After every mass shooting, we post Instagram stories, respond to text threads, ask coworkers, "Did you hear?" Our government spouts platitudes. We cross our fingers, we'll be spared. I'm telling you now that we won't be. If things don't change, everyone in America will soon be or know someone directly impacted by a preventable mass shooting. Gun violence victims are not only the wounded and the dead. They're Melissa, who hustled her children out of harm's way. Leora, who's talked about guts falling out of someone's stomach and keeps wanting to check on her brother. The parade attendees who thought they heard fireworks then fled when told otherwise. The students running through active shooter drills, the moviegoers eyeing the exits just in case, the folks who jump when a car backfires. How can we live like this? Melissa says she'll never attend a large gathering again. She and her husband have discussed leaving the country. Other friends talk about avoiding crowds, missing religious events, ordering online to avoid shopping malls, skipping stadiums to watch sports games on TV. This is not freedom. Our days are dictated by fear because our leadership has chosen guns over our lives. Melissa says they are lucky to be alive, which speaks to our idea of what luck now means. Other families are not so lucky. They come home to rumpled beds and half-eaten yogurts, evidence of lives cut short. They bury and they mourn, and unless we choose our children's futures over a distorted interpretation of a centuries-old document, they can and will be you. That picture, says Melissa, of Leora's drawing. When I took it out of her locker, I just started crying because I was like, oh my God, what if I was coming to pick this up without her? The Personhood Fight Escalates by Madeline Carlyle. In 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Roe v. Wade that before a fetus can survive outside the womb, the point around 24 weeks known as viability, it cannot be guaranteed the legal protections of people under the 14th Amendment, including a right to life. But Roe is gone. In the majority opinion overturning the landmark ruling, Justice Samuel Alito stated, the new decision was not based on any view about if and when prenatal life is entitled to any of the rights enjoyed after birth. Still, laws that establish fetal personhood, extending the legal rights of people to a fetus or embryo before viability, could be the next frontier in the legal battle over reproductive rights in the U.S. At least six states have introduced bills to establish fetal personhood, according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research group that supports abortion rights. It is unclear how they'll hold up in court, but litigation has already begun. The ACLU of Arizona and the Center for Reproductive Rights filed a motion June 25, asking a judge to block Arizona's fetal personhood law from taking effect. Critics argue the state cannot bestow legal rights onto a fetus or embryo without subjugating the rights of the pregnant person. They warn people who self-induce abortions could be at risk for prosecution. In vitro fertilization, IVF, which can create multiple embryos, might be challenged. If it is deemed best for the fetus, pregnant people could be forced to undergo medical procedures they have refused. Abortion laws regulate a procedure, says Rebecca Kluchin, professor at a California State University in Sacramento. Fetal personhood laws allow the state to regulate pregnant women. President Barack Obama, which in turn allowed President Donald Trump to appoint another anti-abortion justice, I apologize, that makes no sense in the running text, so I will leave it at fetal personhood laws allow the state to regulate pregnant women. Doctors Face a Life-Saving Dilemma by Jamie Ducharme and Tara Law. One of the first patients emergency medicine physician Dr. Taylor Nichols ever treated on his own had an ectopic pregnancy, a dangerous condition in which a fertilized egg grows outside the uterus. By the time Nichols examined the woman, she was hemorrhaging. An OBGYN had to operate to save her life. By that point, it was clear there was no other option. But had he been practicing in a state where ending a pregnancy is permissible only when a patient's life is at risk, and had he seen her just a few hours earlier when she was stable, would I have had to call the lawyer instead of the OBGYN? Nichols wonders. That question is hypothetical for Nichols because he works in California where abortion is accessible. But for some providers, it is now reality. About a dozen states have banned or will soon ban nearly all abortions. Even states with anti-abortion laws must make an exception when the life of the mother is at risk, the Biden administration declared July 11th. But deciding when an abortion is life-saving is not always clear-cut. The confusion is already affecting patient care, according to anecdotal reports. Tammy Kromenacher, director of North Dakota's only abortion clinic, which she plans to relocate, says she has fielded questions from North Dakota doctors who worry about treating patients with ectopic pregnancies or incomplete miscarriages, during which the body does not expel all pregnancy-related tissue. As of July 28, providers in the state could face 5 years in prison for providing an abortion, except in cases of rape or incest, or when the pregnant person's life is at risk. A condition that might be manageable for one patient can be life-threatening or altering for another, adds Dr. David Turok, associate professor in the University of Utah Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology and chief of the Division of Family Planning, who emphasized that he was not speaking to Time on behalf of the university. It is hard to understand how Utah's law, which if implemented would permit abortion in cases of substantial risk to the mother, would apply in such circumstances. We are now in a place where we're trying to navigate what legislators and attorneys came up with for language that really does not correlate to medical practice, Turok says. How bad does the medical condition need to be to intervene? If the state disagrees with a clinician's choice, the stakes can be high. In Alabama, performing an abortion could land a provider in prison for life, unless there's serious health risk to the pregnant person. In Arkansas, it could result in a 10-year sentence and or a $100,000 fine, unless the abortion is deemed to be life-saving. And it is not always just one doctor who has to decide whether to take a risk, adds Dr. Maria Rodriguez, a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University School of Medicine. Nurses, anesthesiologists, other providers also take on potential liability. These laws are written by legislators who did not take the time to understand what they were writing laws about, says Dr. Louise Perkins King, an OBGYN and director of reproductive bioethics at Harvard Medical School Center for Bioethics. They have a moral duty to go in and fix that and change these laws so they are clear if they do not want people to die because of them. Here's the seven questions page where a representative from Time asks questions and someone answers them. Today, Belinda Luscombe wrote the column, and Henry Kissinger is the answerer of the questions. Henry Kissinger, the eminence grise on his new book about leadership, how the Internet has made it more difficult, and what he actually thinks about Ukraine. Question, do you consider yourself a leader? Answer by Kissinger. Yes, but more in the intellectual and conceptual field than in the actual political leadership field. Question, you include Richard Nixon in a book of inspired leaders. Are you trying to retilt history in his favor? Answer, not in the sense that I set out to find a way to retell history. In the field of foreign policy, in which I knew him best, he took over a difficult and declining situation and tried to show a way out. Some of his policies in the Middle East and on China set a pattern that lasted for over a generation. Question: how do you think history will judge the leadership of Volodymyr Zelensky? Answer: Zelensky is doing a heroic and extraordinary job in leading a country that normally would not elect somebody of his background as leader. He has made Ukraine a moral cause in a period of great transition. It remains to be seen whether he can institutionalize what he has started. Question: at Davos, you suggested Ukraine might think about ceding some land. Answer: I never said that. What I said is that the best dividing line for a ceasefire is the status quo ante. That is, one should not pursue the war from the territories that were Ukrainian when the war started into territories that had been tolerated or accepted as part of Russia at that time. I warned against turning the war for the freedom of Ukraine into a war about the future of Russia. Question: you write, U.S. foreign policy needs a Nixonian flexibility. What might that look like in the U.S.'s dealings with China? Answer: the two countries have a problem that has never existed before. Technology has become a participant in the sense that its evolution is rapid in a way that is unheard of. A war between them would therefore have implications of catastrophe that were not imaginable even 30 years ago. So the United States and China have a special responsibility. One, to be in contact with each other to define the danger of AI weapons and other technology for each other. And secondly, to make this the basic principle of their foreign policy, even when they disagree. No two countries have ever had that challenge. Question: you are quite gloomy about the effect of the Internet on leadership. Why is that? Answer: the manipulation of the Internet requires such special skills and can evoke such broad reactions that the ability to affect the immediate impact of stories or events can become the preoccupation of leaders rather than a view of a more distant future. And the impact is not just of the Internet, but of technology. Some of the greatest ideas of history, of philosophy, or literature came out of the anguish of struggling for understanding and might never have been reached if there was a helpful assistant who gave an immediately relevant solution. Question: at 98, do you feel hopeful about the world? Answer: I've had the opportunity to participate in many things that, from where I sat, were attempts to improve the world. This possibility now exists in an even wider sense. That is a positive aspect. But I am concerned that if my children's generation does not make progress in understanding the promise and threat of technology, this could become a world of great violence and division. So there's an opportunity and also a danger, and both are relatively unique. In this book, I tried to show how it was done by some people in different times. It is not a cookbook. It is supposed to inspire some reflection. There is a photo here of Henry Kissinger with a lot of wavy white hair, wearing dark-rimmed glasses, a dark suit, a white shirt, a dark tie. His hands are folded in front of him. And here's another question. If you had to pick just one, which leader from your book do you think America needs now? Answer: the country needs somebody like Charles de Gaulle, who recalls it to its essence, even if the definition of that essence is romanticized. He declared as his objective not victory, but regeneration of a lost faith in itself. From the brief business, this short article will be abbreviated even more so. Underworld: Farming the Unfarmable by Nicola Chilton. Sky Kurtz Farms in the Desert. The co-founder and CEO of Pure Harvest Smart Farms, located outside Abu Dhabi, where temperatures regularly top 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and his team used the challenging Averon to trial new crops and technologies that have the potential to change farming in climate-challenged areas. Pure Harvest also provides produce to supermarkets and restaurants in Dubai and across the region using less water, which is important in one of the most arid regions of the world. Kurtz founded Pure Harvest Smart Farms in 2017 with his co-founders Mahmoud Adi and Robert Kupstas. Passionate about food insecurity, they spent the first year studying high-tech food production systems around the world, as well as searching for the optimal site for their first farm. Kurtz's farms in the UAE started out with nothing but a PowerPoint, a pile of dirt, and the promise of what we would do, says Kurtz. But Pure Harvest quickly proved it was built on more than a promise. The founders' research and technological innovation led to the development of a proprietary controlled environmental agriculture, CEA, system, a combination of high-tech greenhouses and vertical farms that provides a stable year-round climate. The first crop of tomatoes was planted in August 2018 and harvested in October. The company's original farm is now its R&D facility, and Pure Harvest has expanded its facilities in the UAE to 16 hectares of growing area. It also operates a 6-hectare farm in Saudi Arabia and is developing a 6-hectare farm in Kuwait. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.